Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, and you have no idea what you're missing. This week, we have a couple of interviews, great ones. David Dayan, Archie Lamb, John Nichols. Which one will you get? Well, you're not going to get all three. Why? Because you're not a member of our podcast. Digby and I go deep on a bunch of these stories from this crazy week. You won't hear it all because you're only listening to the abbreviated version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. So head over to rofpodcast.com. Sign up to get the full show. Just a couple of bucks a week. And you will have access to our entire archives, too. Interviews, Mike Papantonio, Bobby Kennedy, with some of the biggest newsmakers, frankly, in the country. Check it out. ROFpodcast.com. Hear what you're missing on a weekly basis and catch up on what you never heard in our archives. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, the nation's John Nichols will join us to discuss the bizarre week involving Rudy Giuliani's media blitz on behalf of Donald Trump. Investigative journalist David Dayan will explain how political corruption is ruining everything and how we can fix it. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down all the big news stories from this incredibly busy week. And attorney Archie Lamb will join us to recap the Energy and Commerce Committee hearing with opioid distributors earlier this week. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this show. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, obviously just an insane amount of news this week, and but let's dig into it. Let's start first with the Iran deal that Donald Trump has been threatening for quite some time to scuttle and sadly has gone through with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think anybody was entirely surprised. He's obviously been threatening it for, you know, since he's been president. And during the campaign, he was a little bit more dodgy about it. I mean, he would criticize it. He said it was going to lead to the Iranians becoming he said it at one point that it would lead to nuclear holocaust in the hands of Iran. However, he also said that he wouldn't tear up the deal, that he didn't think that was possible, and instead that he would, you know, work to make it tougher, and he gave some to Chuck Todd and Meet the Press, but early on in the campaign, he said this thing about how he was really good at policing contracts, and he'd make sure this contract was properly policed. So at one point, he had the idea that he would keep the deal, but just, you know, it would be a real serious trust but verify kind of situation. He changed along the way. I mean, it's obvious and has been obvious at least since the second half of the campaign and throughout his presidency that he was really dying to tear this deal up. Now, the fact is he didn't tear it up, and that's not something that a president can do. He has announced that he plans to violate the terms of the agreement because he's using as an excuse that the Iranians once lied about having a nuclear program based upon this late sort of pageant that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel put on, in which he, you know, put a bunch of PowerPoint charts and graphs up on a screen suggesting that they had some new information. It turns out none of that was new. Everybody knew that the Iranians had lied about it. this is way back, you know, in the last decade, and that was all factored in to the deal when they made the non-proliferation agreement.
In fact, let me just interject that many people speculate the information that the Israelis presented, that Bibi Netanyahu presented in his sort of like Price is Right presentation that he did, was many people speculate actually came from the IAEA, which is the atomic agency that has been policing these things. So this is information that was already obtained from the Iranians. So it wasn't something that we didn't know when we entered the deal, but it was sort of literally trumped up as a way of giving Trump some cover. It was not particularly successful. In fact, I think if anything, it served to sort of remind people why this deal was so important. But continue, because this is this I think is the one of the most consequential things aside from the judiciary that Donald Trump could and will achieve as president.
Well, I think so too. I mean, this was huge, and you know, it's in the midst of this, you know, this news cyclone that we're in, and so it's hard to sort of prioritize. But I think this is very easy to sort of look at and recognize as being an extremely consequential decision on his part. Now, you know, he had a chance to violate the deal, you know, for months, obviously. He's been in for a while and was talked down from it by Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster, both of whom, you know, Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, and McMaster, the former National Security Advisor, they're both gone. He got rid of them, and they were sort of the voices of reasons, along with General Mattis, who had once been a harsh critic of the deal and had come around in recent years, and had been and had actually, you know, teamed up with Tillerson and McMaster to try and keep Trump from completely violating the deal. But in any case, Mattis was outnumbered with the new group that's in there, particularly John Bolton. He gave plenty of ammunition, and it seems obvious to me that he and Mike Pompeo and Bibi Netanyahu cooked this up, you know, cooked up their little presentation together to just give Trump that final push to go against all the allies. I mean, the Europeans, they sent over Macron, they had Angela Merkel, and then finally even Boris Johnson, who you would think that Trump would actually pay some attention to, he came over in the last minute to try and talk Trump out of violating the deal, and none of it worked. I think this sort of shows the influence of John Bolton and Pompeo. I think that they are very, very influential now in the Trump presidency, and that's part of what is so significant about this. It also shows, I think, a serious breach for the first time, and I think this is really serious, between the United States and our allies. What happened with them truly making an appeal to Trump on a number of bases, but also just the essential sort of appeal that, look, this, you know, we did this together. We are your allies. We are the people, you know, the countries that you are supposed to care about, and this is very important to us, and you're going to do this, and everybody knows he's doing it for superficial reasons, right? I mean, everyone knows that Trump is an idiot, so he's doing it mostly to reverse Barack Obama's legacy. He paid no attention, and I think that maybe this may signal, and I certainly had that feeling, that at that full court press by the Europeans in Britain, it signals a real breach, something that we haven't seen, you know, I don't think since World War II. I think this is a big, big issue, and I think things are going to start to move. The chessboard has changed significantly, and we're talking, you know, during the last decade about stateless actors and, you know, all this stuff about terrorism, but we're kind of back to big, great game stuff now with big powers moving in different directions, and I think Trump just basically upended one end of the board.
Yes.
And some very, very significant consequences are going to come from this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have actually sort of two or three different orders of consequences that are going to come from this. And let's take a break. We'll talk a little bit more about that. We've got a lot of news to cover. This has been a really crazy week And again, this Iran deal is, I think, the breach of this deal is one of the most consequential things that when we look back on the Trump presidency and the damage it has done to our country and maybe more, I think this is going to be one of the things that we look at. Are we going to take a quick break? I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Heather Parton.
It's in my blood, it's in my water. You tried to tame me from the start. When that deadness in your eye, flash your flesh, desperate for a need to ride.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were starting to talk about President Donald Trump's decision earlier this week and denouncement, I should say, of that he intends, on behalf of the United States, to breach the Iran agreement. And let's be clear, because I don't think this is articulated enough, frankly, when people talk about this. This is not a unilateral, I should say, a bilateral deal between the United States and Iran. This is a deal that includes the EU and includes China and Russia. I mean, so there are many players to this. And the deal did not impose sanctions on Iran. We already have sanctions on Iran. What the deal did is it unfroze some assets, but also said that in the event that Iran follows the terms of the deal, which are very specific, and I don't want to say onerous, but they are very rigid in terms of inhibiting Iran's ability to build a nuclear weapon. You don't have to believe me. You can believe Mad Dog Mattis, who said that he read the thing over three times and found all of the controls to be very sound, I guess. And this is a deal that basically says, we will not impose sanctions on European countries, European actors, or, you know, to the extent that we could on China or Russia, on entities that do business with Iran. And now we are threatening to do so as a breach of this agreement. So people should be very clear about this. The other thing that I think that people need to be clear about is that from the beginning, in fact, the Israeli government promoted this idea, and there were people in the foreign policy establishment of this country promoted this idea. The deal was structured narrowly, not to deal with Iran as an actor on the world stage writ large, but rather to deal specifically with the idea of Iran developing a nuclear weapon and from preventing them from doing so. And the deal did that quite well. And so... we should make that clear that when you hear critiques of this deal, that it doesn't deal with Iranian support for Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever it is. The deal was never intended to do that. And there's certainly no indication that it has strengthened Iran's dealings in that regard any more so than, let's say, our invasion of Iraq and destroying any type of counterbalance in the region to them. But with all that said, let's talk about the implications of this. It seems to me that it can go in a couple of different directions, and you've basically articulated the worst case scenario. Well, I shouldn't say that. The worst case scenario is that this is a prelude to a war. Right. And I think, you know, certainly the Netanyahu, I think, is hoping towards that. And we should be clear that if you look at the Israeli Israeli national security essentially apparatus, broadly speaking, very much wanted the United States to stay in this deal. Also the case in this country. But we do have political leadership in both countries that think it's in their best interest to be at a adversarial place with Iran. Hopefully we will not see a war. But that's the worst case scenario, that this leads to war. And I'm sure there are many, many people who were proponents of scrapping this deal, who are hoping that that's ultimately where it ends up. But you don't have to have this to be a disaster to end in war. It, like you said in the last segment, we have just backed out of an agreement. We have just broken an agreement that we brokered with five, six other countries and over many years. And there doesn't seem to even be a remote rationale for it whatsoever. And this sends a message to all of these countries that, like, you know, the modus operandi of international relations is being assaulted here, right? It's not just this deal. It is the idea, like, you know, like, to the extent that there's a common language, like, you know, this is it. The idea is that we negotiate with partners and get into deals with people who have governments that are stable enough that you do not willy-nilly go back on, you know, that your commitments don't change willy-nilly based upon who gets elected, but rather there's some type of long-term perspective here. And Donald Trump has just shattered that, it seems to me.
Oh, I think he has. And, you know, my belief is he's clueless about what he's doing. I don't think he personally understands the implication. His foreign policy philosophy, if there is such a thing, is that, you know, he's going to make demands and he's going to, you know, send angry tweets and he's going to rattle his sword and then they will capitulate and America will win and they will lose. And that's how the world is going to be structured. I mean, he really seems to believe that this is, and he calls that negotiating. I've never heard of that sort of negotiation. That's something that's more like a mob kidnapping or, you know, some kind of, you know, protection racket or something. But in any case, I think that's really the extent of his understanding of how foreign policy is supposed to work. But he does have people around him, and specifically now John Bolton, who I mentioned earlier, who was part of this cadre going back into the 90s.
Yep.
That was always hungry to invade Iran. There was, you know, this has been, in fact, it was more of a fetish than invading Iraq. And indeed, back in the day, when you remember this, when we were talking about all this, there was a saying, you know, everyone wants to go to Baghdad, real men go to Tehran.
Right.
That was the ultimate objective of the neocons who were behind the Iraq war invasion, was to start off with Iraq, and then they would move into Tehran, and then, you know,
into Baghdad.
Beyond
I mean,
that, it would
Damascus.
Be Damascus,
right.
Beirut, you know, Khartoum, right. Pyongyang, etc. And their idea was, and in fact, Richard Perle was quoted at the time saying that a successful invasion of Iraq said we could deliver a short message to the world, a two-word message: "You're next." So, I mean, that's not very different than Donald Trump. I mean, Trump
yep.
is simplistic and kind of a, you know, a cretinous imbecile, but that's essentially the same thing, right? I mean, you take away all
Indeed.
The fancy neocon verbiage about, you know, spreading democracy, and that's what you're left with.
He just
so
wants
Bolton
to win.
One of those
but
guys.
Heather, we have to take a break. We'll talk a little bit more about this in the next hour if you'll join me. We also got to just mention, at the very least, that Donald Trump hired a private Israeli spy team to basically smear some of the people who worked on that deal. We'll talk about that in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Heather Partner Digby will join me in hour two. Coming up, Ring of Fire Radio favorite David Dayan on his latest investigative piece that you won't want to miss. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Political corruption is nothing new, but there is a way to fix it before it ruins our democracy. Here to discuss his latest piece on the subject for The Nation magazine, investigative reporter David Dayan. So, David, in your piece in The Nation, Political Corruption is Ruining Everything, But We Can Fix It, You cite a couple of examples. I feel like since the piece has come out, we have probably a half dozen more that we have found out about this week. Right. Not the least of which is some type of pay-to-play operation coming out of the president's right-hand man. But, you know, I don't know if it's any different from Corey Lewandowski, who seems to be doing this for months at the least. But tell
certainly.
Us about...
I mean, the Trump administration certainly has highlighted the level of corruption, public corruption, littered throughout the system. That's not to say that it wasn't present prior to then, but it certainly has kicked up a notch in terms of its visibility.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I mean, I want to go into some of these examples, but broadly speaking, I can't tell if the, and maybe it's a little bit of both, but if the Trump administration is, you know, because of the people they hire and because just broadly speaking it signals to everybody. I mean, I've been in situations where I've been in, how can I put this diplomatically? I have been in enterprises where at one point it appears like everybody is just trying to grab what's not nailed down and run. And there is a contagious effect to it. Like you look around, you're saying, well, if everybody else is doing this, why shouldn't I do this? So I guess the question is, do you think there's more corruption going on now? Or is it that there's more sensitivity to it because of who Donald Trump is and how ostentatious he is with that corruption?
I think it's the latter. I don't think there's necessarily more corruption going on now than in previous eras in Washington. I mean, certainly you can look to the Jack Abramoff era and the Tom DeLay era. You had John Boehner giving out checks on the House floor from tobacco lobbyists. You can go all the way back to Watergate. Trump's people are not good at it, so it's not well hidden in the way that it might be under a more sophisticated group of officials. So I do think that this is a deep-seated problem, and the report that really this story was covering from the Roosevelt Institute also makes the case that this is a deep-seated problem in American life that has a lot to do with how we fail to police corruption, how we only really are attentive to it in times of major scandal, like after Watergate or perhaps now.
That's interesting. Before we get specifically to that that report on stacking the deck, you know, one of the things that obviously in the news this week were $200,000 at least of payments from AT&T to Michael Cohen. At least, mm-hmm. I don't know, it sounds like maybe $1 million plus now from Novartis to Michael Cohen. And yeah. My thought was like, wait a second, where did AT&T get the idea they could do this type of thing, right? Like this, they didn't come up with the idea. It seems to me that if they feel comfortable paying Michael Cohen this money, it's not the first time they've done this, right? And so this
it's not
is
the
something...
first time any corporation has done it. I mean, you know, they call it consulting when it's not as overt as what Michael Cohen is doing. There are entire offices within large law firms in all over Washington where consultants who are usually people who have attachments to the government, who have contacts within the government, are paid for their insights. There's an entire industry around it. It's called political intelligence. And, you know, this has been on the table for a long, long time. And Michael Cohen is just so ham-handed about it that it sort of raises attention to this much, much larger, almost an industry of paying people who are marginally attached to people in power to, you know, effectively lobby for them without calling it lobbying.
All right. Well, let's talk about this report, Unstacking the Deck. It was issued from the Roosevelt Institute. Tell us about the report, and then let's talk about the authors, because in some respects, the authors are just as interesting as the report itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So the report, a lot of these reports are often about money and politics. You hear about corruption in the sense of somebody got a campaign donation, and then they took an action on behalf of that campaign donor. And that's not actually what this report does. This report is about what they term as money in government. And it's around all of the money used to influence regulators at federal agencies and other policymakers to, again, take actions on behalf of that individual industry or company. But it's not about campaign contributions. It's about the lobbying expenses. It's about the expenses that companies like Google use to plant academic research. They pay academics to write research that's favorable to their policies. It's this whole blob of interests that push policymakers or attempt to push them in a certain direction. And as you said, it's notable who wrote this report. The authors were, you know, affiliated with Roosevelt Institute, Julie Morgan. The other one is a guy named Rohit Chopra. And Rohit Chopra wrote this while he was waiting to get confirmed to a commissioner position at the Federal Trade Commission. So he is now one of those officials on the other side of the table who is going to be subject to this large influence industry attempting to change his mind or get his vote on a whole variety of matters. I mean, the Federal Trade Commission covers advertising, which practically every consumer-facing industry engages in. It has jurisdiction over the tech industry, one of the largest spenders of lobbying funds in Washington. It has its tentacles in numerous parts of the economy, and now that firepower is going to be brought to bear on Rohit Chopra, who shows through this report that he knows exactly what he's in for.
He's a fascinating figure because I had heard of his work during the Obama administration when it came to, I think, if I remember correctly, student loans, but also in particular for-profit universities. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. He's a sort of protege of Elizabeth Warren, worked in the CFPB as the student loan ombudsman. Later went to the education department where he tried to write rules on things like student loan servicing and for-profit colleges. So yes, he's been sort of at the forefront of a lot of these consumer issues, at least as they relate to students. And so, you know, it's definitely notable that this is someone who's about to go into the government researching government corruption and knowing already, having already served in the government from the inside, knowing how the industry brings that influence to bear on people. There's real world experience within this report that you can just feel that, you know, this is the way things work.
All right, we've got to take a quick break. I'm talking to the great David Dayan. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Do you slide on all your knives like this? Try on all your knives like this.
I might
put some spotlight on the slide.
We're back. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to investigative journalist David Dayan about a few of his recent pieces that you can read over at daviddayan.tumblr.com. So, David, when we broke in the last segment, you were talking about this report called Unstacking the Deck, which is which discusses corporate influence on various elements of our society. Both using it as an example, evidence that the Charles Koch Foundation had been given outsized input, certainly unique and unusual, we hope, input into the hiring and firing of professors by the amount of money that they gave to George Mason University. That is atypical. The president of the university himself said that it was an unfortunate mistake and bad decision on their part. But also talking about corruption, not necessarily in the political process when it comes to campaigns, but rather that corporations are using huge amounts of money to influence decisions that are made on an agency level. And this money can go towards creating essentially bought data, bought research, perhaps grassroots or fake grass astroturf campaigns, and obviously a barrage of lobbyists. And it's one of the writers, Rohit Chopra, is a man who has come out of the agency work at the CFPB and at the Education Department, is going back into the FTC. I want to just hear a little bit more about what we can do to fix it. But how did Rohit Chopra end up on the FTC? How does that happen when theoretically this is these are things that the Trump administration would appoint people to?
Right. So when you have commissions like the FTC that are multi-member commissions, they are usually oriented in such a way that the majority party, the president's party, can only have a certain number of people on that commission. So the FTC is a five-member commission, and it's composed by law, by statute, of three Republicans and two Democrats. So Chopra is one of the two minority party members on the FTC. And that's actually kind of an interesting fight on how he got on there. Chuck Schumer was considering, you know, Chuck Schumer being the Senate minority leader and sort of in position to recommend these minority party members to these federal commissions. He at first was considering his former chief of staff, this guy who was a lobbyist for Yahoo and Airbnb and sort of disinterested in stiffer policies on the tech industry. And once that got out, there was a lot of criticism, and Schumer shifted to putting Rohit Chopra, who I would say is sort of the polar opposite of that, on the commission. So that's you know, good news in and of itself, and it brings someone who has an understanding not only of the nature of this problem, but how it affects our democracy, how it affects our economy, which I thought was a really interesting point in the paper, talking about how if money can buy this influence, then the bigger companies simply can outgun smaller companies to get more favorable rules. And if that's the most important way that you can sort of build a moat around your company and around your business, then it takes that money that could be used in the real economy to create jobs and create investment, and then just pours it into Washington. So that, you know, you can just sort of win market share by rigging the rules in your favor. And so Chopra understands that. He wrote about that. And he also understands, I think, ways that we can go about fixing it.
Yeah, I mean, tell me about that, because I've had this argument with libertarians in the past, where they argue that because government is so big, that corporations come and it corrupts it, and because it like you say, buys essentially rules and regulations that benefit that specific corporation. And their solution is you've got to weaken and shrink government. That way corporations cannot corrupt it.
Yeah, well, that's absurd, because then you just have, instead of regulation by public, rules and regulations, you have regulation by private industry. And if you eliminate the sort of middleman of government, you're going to get a private industry regulating the economy in their own interests. And so I fundamentally disagree with that. The truth is, and what this paper shows, is that we actually have a lot of positions that are focused on this type of public corruption. The problem is they don't have the tools, and they don't have the teeth, and they're not sort of centralized and given more authority. And so the big proposal here is to create what they call a public integrity protection agency that would consolidate all of these anti-corruption pieces of government, whether it's the Office of Government Ethics, or inspectors general within agencies, or ethics officials. It would put them all in one agency that would be able to investigate with subpoena power and penalize government officials and the other side of the equation, lobbyists, influence seekers, while being able to, you know, write rules and further crack down on this type of corruption. So it's not that we don't have the manpower. It's that that manpower isn't really empowered, for lack of a better word, to actually do something about this. So the Public Integrity Protection Agency, I think it's similar to sort of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency that took all these different consumer protection laws and put them under one house. So that's really the big proposal in there. But there are a lot of other ones, and you can read about them at the story.
It seems like organizing it in that way makes the agency and its personnel less susceptible to wanting to enter into one of the industries that they are regulating, because in many respects, they're really just policing agencies less than they are sort of bridging some type of relationship between an agency and an industry.
Right. And then the other way to do it is to set like really hardline rules that, you know, individuals cannot enter certain positions if they had worked as a lobbyist or as a government contractor. And these bright line restrictions rather than, you know, disclosure forms or things like that, where you kind of rely on public rebuke or shame to do the job, I think have the potential of being much more successful.
All right. Well, look, we're just about out of time. We're not going to have enough time to do justice to your piece on how America broke its economy. But in some respects, it's a compliment to your story on political corruption, which is that we have too many corporations in this country that have amassed a huge amount of outsized amount of economic power and have translated that into political power as well. And it is diminished the ability of society and of workers themselves to be able to sort of increase wages at a time where you would anticipate there would be higher wages for folks.
Right. We're sitting, just real quick, we're sitting on 3.9% unemployment. The way the typical economics 101 story goes is that as unemployment shrinks, workers have better bargaining power to bid up their services because there simply aren't anyone, there's nobody available to take their place. So they become more indispensable and they can get higher wages. But that channel has broken somehow. For the last 2 years, wages have been relatively stagnant on real terms, whereas the unemployment rate keeps falling and falling and falling. And what is going on there is, as you said, a lot of rules that have been put in place to bolster employer power and take away power from workers. And, you know, as a result of that sort of lobbying success or success of you know, conflicts of interest and self-dealing, you have this inability for people to get these higher wages.
David Dayen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today.
All right, thanks.
David Dayen is the author of the bestseller Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize for Journalism. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.